Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Tinseltown Tragedies Uncut. This particular episode contains an uncut interview whose portions were included in the Who Killed Krista Helm episode of the series. In this episode, we speak with author John O'Dowd, who co-wrote a wonderful article on Krista at his website, john-odowd.com. You can hear the episode Who Killed Krista Helm in its entirety at our website at moviegeeksunited.net.
A lot of people didn't know of her story at all. The response has been mixed, to tell you the truth, in the past 7 years. A lot of it has been positive, and unfortunately some of it has been negative. People suggesting that she possibly deserved to end up in a situation like what happened to her, which I can't understand at all. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. But you can't figure out how people are going to react to a story.
It really does. I mean, I love online, and obviously because you and I both try to do great things online and indulge in the passions that we have.
Yes.
But I kind of miss the period of time before there was an internet, when we didn't know there was such kind of animosity and viciousness out there.
Absolutely.
But,
absolutely. Yeah, it never fails to surprise me. The degree of animus a lot of people show, especially when they don't know who they're speaking with or talking to.
Yeah.
They'll just let the vitriol, you know, fly.
Yeah.
Any time they want, and it gets pretty sick, actually. It really does.
I think it's the protection of anonymity that really empowers these people. They've been there all along, but now they have a forum to kind of express it. But you know, I'll tell you that earlier this year, I don't live in L.A. I live in Florida, but I try to get to L.A. as much as possible. I took a trip earlier this year there, and we went it sounds ghoulish, but it was actually very entertaining and enlightening on kind of like a death tour.
Yes, I heard of that.
Yeah, and it was completely fascinating. And I thought to myself, we need to do a series of shows on you know, the old Hollywood scandals and try to demystify it and try to bring some new information to light for people too. And that's when I found the 48 Hours episode on Krista Helm. I did not know anything about that story prior to that. And then, I found your beautiful article online that reinforced a lot of that. But
very little was written about her death at the time that it happened.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
The newspapers reported it very heavily for whatever reason. I'm not sure why that is.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, because just from a media standpoint, it's got all the elements of a juicy, you know, Hollywood story, really.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of people have called it a modern-day Black Dahlia type story, and in a lot of ways it is.
Yeah.
You know, especially because of the brutality of both of their deaths, Krista's and Elizabeth Short's.
Yeah. So tell me what you can about Elizabeth, or not Elizabeth, about Krista. You just said Elizabeth Short. About Krista prior to her arrival on the L.A. scene. Tell me what you know about her growing up and family life and aspirations.
Right. Well, she was raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Her father, Harry, was he worked for an asphalt company, and her mom, Dolores, was a housewife. And from what I've been told, her mom was an alcoholic, and it caused a lot of problems in her parents' marriage. And I think they split up about 3 years after Krista's birth. She and her two sisters stayed with their mom for a few years, but because of her mom's lifestyle, they were exposed to a lot of unsavory people. Her mom had taken to seeing a lot of different men, and I guess a lot of them were abusive, and the girls were more or less terrorized by these individuals, and they went to live finally with their father, who had remarried. And Krista was said to be very fearless as a teenager, quite forward, strong. She didn't suffer fools gladly, let's put it that way. And a bit on the wild side.
Yeah.
And by age 16, she decided to elope with an older guy, a 27-year-old man named Gary Clements, who was rumored to be involved in the mob in Milwaukee. And their marriage was very brief, and I think he disappeared shortly afterward. She didn't see him again or didn't see him for several years. Anyway, she gave birth to a daughter, Nicole, in August 1967. And in the late 60s, she decided to move to New York City with her friend Diane Mitchell to pursue a career in modeling. And that's really where her show business career started in New York.
Mm. So she was, do you think, because, I mean, a major part of her story that we're going to get to involves her gaining a sense of self-empowerment and trying to get to the next level in her career, and
yes,
and men, her relationships with men was an essential component of achieving that for her.
Right.
And looking at her background, I mean, I'm not to play closet psychologist, but I mean, it seems like if what you're saying is accurate about the men that came in and out of her mother's life, it seems like maybe the idea was born then that she would use her own allure to actually empower herself and get what she wanted out of life.
Totally agree. I think there was an element of subconscious revenge at play mm-hmm. later on, and because I was told by several people that she enjoyed manipulating the men in her life. She actually kind of got off on it. So I'm sure that had its genesis in what she was exposed to as a young person.
Yeah. How much luck did she have with modeling once she and her friend moved to New York?
I'm not sure how much luck she had. I've never been able to actually find any evidence of her modeling in terms of, you know, photos or magazine spreads or anything like that. But at some point while she was living in Manhattan, she met a wealthy producer named Stuart Duncan, who became her main benefactor, so to speak. And he more or less promoted her career and tried to help her a lot. Helping her make connections and things like that.
Was he involved in the Broadway play that she ended up investing in? Or?
Yes, he was the producer of Godspell. And our research, Steve's and my research, showed that she had invested some money into the production of Godspell. I'm not entirely sure if it was her money or Stuart Duncan's. But at any rate, she supposedly made a profit from the success of the play.
Yeah.
And at one point, he set her up in a beautiful apartment on the east side, 7-room duplex, and it was lavishly furnished. And she was doing quite well for herself, probably by 1970-71.
Hmm. And how did that, well, first of all, tell me about her daughter during this point, because her daughter did not go on these journeys with her, did she?
No, she didn't. Her daughter was left behind with Krista's mother, Dolores, until it was decided that she would be better off in different surroundings, because evidently Dolores's alcoholism had worsened by then. And so it was decided that Nicole would be given to a nanny to care for. And the nanny was a woman named Gertrude Baker, and she lived in Vermont. So that's where Nicole grew up, in a small town in Vermont.
Do you think that in your feelings, how important was Krista's daughter in her life?
I'm not really sure, in all honesty. I would like to think that she loved her deeply, and but Krista was very ambitious, and I think her ambition was probably her motivating force in those years, and I think her relationship with her daughter was definitely on the back burner for a long time, for many years.
Yeah. So what led her to L.A.? Did she go straight to L.A. from New York?
Yes. Before she went to L.A., Stuart Duncan financed a film project to promote Krista, and it was called Let's Go for Broke, and it was an adventure film produced partially in Haiti. Mm. And Krista had the lead role of an investigative journalist, and it was definitely a grade Z production. But he financed the entire project, and I think there were a lot of problems tied to the project, and it took several years for it. That was in 1973, and I think by 75 she had moved to Hollywood to pursue acting. She wanted to be to work in TV and in films out there.
Well, were there mob connections in some way to Let's Go for Broke too?
I'm not really sure about that. Steve Thompson may know about that more than I do. That doesn't ring a bell, to tell you the truth.
I think he mentioned something about that, because what's odd is it seems like on the periphery, the mob presence was there through many events throughout her life.
I believe that too.
Yeah.
I think she had an adventurous streak in her, and she kind of liked hanging out with dangerous types.
Yeah.
And I could see where she would gravitate towards mobsters and thugs and, you know, lowlifes, people like that.
Right.
Well,
she
characters. You
exactly, yeah. But you said that she went for TV work when she was in L.A., and she had some success with that because she was in stuff like Wonder Woman and Starsky and Hutch, and so there's footage of her. I mean, so she did have some success there.
She had a small role in Wonder Woman and basically just a bit part in Starsky and Hutch, and her daughter told me once that Krista also did a Coppertone TV commercial, and that she was auditioning for the Cheryl Ladd role on Charlie's Angels at the time that she was murdered. She had already auditioned for that part.
Mm.
So that was kind of fascinating to me to hear.
Now, a big part of the story, too, that came out in the 48 Hours episode that I saw was that she supposedly kept a diary or recorded encounters that she had with various celebrities, I guess. Is that hearsay, or do we know for a fact that those existed?
Krista's roommate, Stephanie Warshaw, her roommate in Hollywood, unequivocally denies the existence of any love diary or sex diary, whatever you want to call it. She said Krista did have an address book with many people's names in it, and there were many Hollywood stars' names in it, especially, you know, male stars that she knew. But it wasn't a diary. However, she did record her several instances, several dates or liaisons with different Hollywood actors. And those tapes did in fact exist. They were later taken, though, after her death, and I'm not sure if any of them have resurfaced in the past 30 years.
Did she ever express to her roommate or anyone else her motivations for recording those encounters?
No. Stephanie doesn't feel that Krista was about extorting money from anyone. She didn't think that was her style. She highly doubts that allegation, and she doesn't think Krista would have ever done that. It could have just been a kinky habit, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But as for the diary, Stephanie insists that there was no diary. And yet, that seems to be mentioned quite a lot whenever Krista's story is mentioned. The diary is right there, you know, right there in the description of her death.
Yeah, because it's, that's the major element of old-time Hollywood scandal right there. I mean, for lack of a better word, that's the kind of the romanticism of the whole thing.
Absolutely.
For a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I guess in a way it makes her story more enticing for a certain element of people, you know.
They yeah.
Kind of like the thought of this. Of this diary floating around that could implicate, you know, any number of people in what happened to her.
So if it wasn't a diary and it was, but she did keep some kind of black book of contacts and that kind of stuff.
That
went missing or that disappeared?
Yes, that actually Lenny Barron, who was a clothing designer, confidant / friend of Krista's, came to her apartment after Krista's murder and absconded with the address book, some of the tapes, and Krista's wardrobe, her furs and her clothing. It wasn't Lenny, I don't know how you say his name, Lenny Sirico from...
Tony Sirico, yeah.
Yeah, Tony Sirico. It wasn't Tony Sirico who came to the apartment. It was Lenny Barron, according to Stephanie Warshaw. And he left with Krista's belongings and evidently brought them back to his home with him.
So, okay, so Tony didn't go to the apartment, according to the roommate, but Tony was still part of the story, if only because he was seeing Krista's sister? Is that what was happening?
Yes, he dated or saw her sister Marisa Rahm. I think she also went by the name of Marisa Helm, and he was dating her at some point. So he and Krista evidently knew each other, but I don't know how well.
So why did he get dragged into this as such a big part of the story?
Tony?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure because... I'm in close contact with Stephanie Warshaw, and she insists that it was Lenny Barron who came to the apartment to get Krista's things, and Tony was nowhere to be seen. He had no part in that.
And she gave him that stuff willingly. He didn't
yeah,
take
she,
it. With,
she yeah. was more or less blindsided by it because she said he was in such a panic, and because of what had happened, she wasn't in her right mind, so to speak. She
yeah.
was very upset. So she allowed him to take whatever he came to take. And I guess for many years he held on to these things, but then, you know, he passed away, I think, about 15 years ago. So I'm not sure what ever happened to Krista's possessions that he had.
Well, I think the police have some of the audio...
I'm sure
tapes
you're right.
She,
yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me another part of this puzzle, which occurred, you know, just prior to her death, was she wanted to try to cut a music album. What were the relationships that she kind of molded from that experience? Who were those characters?
Well, she hooked up with a radio personality. I think he was an East Coast disc jockey named Frankie Crocker. And he was evidently well-known at the time. And he was hired to produce the session. And Krista was involved along with two backup singers named Debbie Danilo and Patty Collins. And a keyboard player named Blair Aronson was also on the session. But evidently it was a very contentious project. And I don't know whether there was professional jealousy involved or personalities that didn't mesh. And there were a lot of problems during the production, I guess, of this record. And also at the time, there was rumored to be a love affair between Krista and Patty Collins, the backup singer. And Patty was said to be very jealous of Krista and very territorial of her. And I guess she alienated a lot of people on the project. And there were just a lot of problems. It was a project that was fraught with problems.
Mm. So what's interesting to me, I mean, we're about to get to the actual crime itself, but if what I've read, there was, I mean, there was no DNA at the time. That technology had not come around yet.
Yes.
But the
right.
the one piece of blood evidence that they did find was underneath Krista's. Was it underneath her nails? Where was it on her?
Yes, underneath her finger, one of her fingernails. There was female DNA found.
Mm.
Which that was like a smoking gun type aspect, you know. It was quite a revelation, I guess, when they discovered that.
I would imagine so, because if it's underneath her feet, her fingernails, then that spells out evidence that she was trying to defend herself.
Absolutely right, right.
Mm.
And some think that Patty Collins was involved because, evidently, I guess she and Krista had some personal issues, some problems, and Krista had told her to get lost. She was angry. She was jealous. And then there's the other camp that thinks the other backup singer, Debbie Danilo, might have somehow been involved, but she denies it, you know, vehemently. So it's a real puzzle.
Do you know if either of their DNA matched?
I do know that Debbie Danilo's DNA did not match. They've been unable to, the detectives that were on the case 6 or 7 years ago, Detectives Brandenburg and Harris, were unable to find Patty Collins at the time.
Okay.
And I don't know, you know, since that time if they've located her. But they were interested in getting a sample of her DNA as well.
What's also interesting to me, speaking about the night that she was murdered, is it came out that the original detective always held to the idea that it had something to do with Sal Mineo, since he was murdered by stabbing in that same area 1 year to the day that Krista was, 1 year before.
That's right.
Do you put any credit into that theory?
No, I don't. Mainly because of the degree of overkill in Krista's murder. It was a rage killing. And I'm not sure if Sal Mineo's murder was also a rage killing, but I tend to believe that Krista's killer was absolutely someone who knew her, and that they were someone who were very angry with her, very angry. And now I kind of think it was a coincidence that both killings happened on the same day, 1 year apart.
Yeah. So tell me about that night. Where was she coming from, and where was she going when this occurred?
Well, according to Stephanie Warshaw, Krista had attended a party. However, Stephanie says Krista barely knew Sandy Smith, who it's been said was Krista's agent at the time. Stephanie said Sandy Smith was more of a friend to her than to Krista. And yet it was outside Sandy Smith's home where Krista was found. So I'm not sure what to think of. Evidently she had left one party and was en route to another or another get-together, and that's when she was ambushed in the street on Lloyd Place in West Hollywood and attacked from behind, stabbed 22 times, and bludgeoned with a blunt object. And apparently her screams were heard by a neighbor who came out to the sidewalk and looked for the source of these screams, but he wasn't able to see anything. And it was later said that if he had actually walked out to the street, he probably would have seen the murder take place.
Oh, my God.
And his name is John Grease.
And he's an actor, isn't he? Or he
He's an actor and the son of a former 1950s actress in Hollywood named Marla English, who has a bit of a cult following. And yeah, he's her son.
So all of these wounds took place in the upper torso and head?
Yes, the neck, the face, her face. Her upper torso. It's very sad. Very, very sad.
And you make a great point that obviously a murder of this kind isn't a simple mugging. It was personal. It was probably vengeful, and it almost, those kinds of wounds, they almost wanted to defile her in a
yes,
way.
Destroy her looks. Don't you think
so?
That's,
I would imagine.
That's the feeling I have.
Yeah. So when was, did somebody call the, who called the police? When did the police arrive and what did they find?
Well, I think it was Detective Ganzi who was the detective who was assigned to the case, and he came upon her body lying underneath a car, and of course she was already dead and covered in blood, and he said it was a scene that he never forgot, and he was a veteran of the LA Sheriff's Department, I guess, and he said that was one scene that he never ever forgot throughout his career. So it must have been very gruesome.
Didn't somebody happen upon her, though, before, and alerted the cops to it? I don't remember who it was, but somebody found her, and they said that it almost sounded like they heard her give her last breath or something when they approached.
Yes, I think you're right about that. I'm not entirely sure, but I think you are right. I can't recall right now.
How far did the, it's in cold case now, and, you know, I think they investigated if they receive a new tip, but outside of that, it's a 37-year-old murder. How far did the investigation go, and who were the main suspects at that time?
I think one of the people they questioned was a drug dealer, Hollywood drug dealer at the time named Rudy Mazzella, whom Krista knew because she had gotten into hanging out with a bad crowd, fringe types and out-and-out, drug dealers and criminals in Hollywood. And at some point, he had even admitted to killing her. He had made a statement to one of his friends or cronies that he was responsible for her death. However, the detectives who interviewed him at that time were not convinced of the veracity of his claims. And in fact, he later recanted his, his admission. But he was one of the suspects at the time, and I guess other people who were in her circle. But then after a while, I heard that the Hillside Strangler case took precedence, and Krista's murder was more or less put on the back burner. The investigation into her murder was kind of put aside for whatever.
And it had to have been challenging because she was around so many people. She was in all of these different circles, some of them very questionable circles. And so it must have felt like quite a labyrinth to sort through all of those acquaintances.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because she knew the upper echelon in Hollywood. You know, she knew Warren Beatty and Ryan O'Neill, Jack Nicholson. I think she was friendly with Mick Jagger and people like that. And then on the flip side, she also knew a lot of dangerous characters who, you know, who lived in the shadows. And so it was a real dichotomy of humanity.
Do we get a sense that she felt that she was in danger? Is there any evidence that she felt something was bad was going to take place?
Well, her lifelong friend, Darlene Thorson, claims that Krista had sent her a postcard a few days or weeks before her death, in which she had told Darlene that she was in fear for her life and that she had gotten into some trouble that she didn't know how to get out of. So possibly Darlene would be able to tell you more about that. I remember her telling me about that, and it, you know, it's pretty upsetting that she had that sense that she was in.
Yeah. You know, what's striking to me about what you do when you're investigating something like this and you're writing about it is when you're covering a life story and a story of a death, do you become invested in it? Do you start to feel like you have, like you know this person and you have a responsibility to tell their story? They become a part of you in a sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've had that experience more with other people I've written about. For instance, I wrote a book about a 1950s starlet named Barbara Payton who had a very tragic life, and I was very emotionally invested. I had it to a degree with Krista as well, but actually I find it kind of coming back now, and now that I'm speaking with you and going over her notes and all the material that I've accrued, you know, over the last 10 years or so, I've kind of renewed my feelings of compassion for her.
Yeah.
And I kind of understand what she was about, and I don't think she was a bad person. I think she was misguided. But from what I've heard and read, she was actually a very warm person, a very outgoing and friendly and sweet girl, and a bit mercenary, perhaps. But I mean, she didn't have, you know, terrible qualities, you know, that where she would deserve an end like what, you know, what she suffered.
Yeah.
Well, no.
No one does. But I understand a lot of people were quite taken with her and thought that she was a very sweet girl.
Very sweet. Yep. A bit ballsy, a bit forward. But actually, maybe she was an archetype because you see that all the time these days. You know, no one thinks twice about it, but, you know, maybe 30, 35 years ago, that was a bit rare, you know, a little bit more unique.
Well, and it's always been, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. But it's always been a cutthroat business if you want to break in entertainment. And so you have to be very assertive, and you have to use whoever you can to kind of get to the finish line in a way. But
it's the way of the world. It's the way of the world out
that's
there.
That's true. Yeah. You know what also speaks to me about it is that I mean, years and years ago, when I was a teenager and I first became aware of the stories behind the Kennedy assassination, I became obsessed with that. And after a while, I said, you know, this is a rabbit hole. I've got to back off. But part of the appeal of these kinds of stories is the human need to know the unknowable. But there's an answer out there. It's right there, but we just don't know how to get it, you know?
That's right. Yeah, it's frustrating, isn't it?
Yes.
So frustrating. But it's compelling. It really draws you in and hooks you. And it's intoxicating in a way. It's addictive. And pretty soon, it's very easy to be consumed by that. Very easy to be consumed. And I've just been thinking a lot about her lately, and I feel such empathy for her that I really haven't felt since I worked on that article with Steve. You know, I feel it all over again. And I want justice to be served for her.
There needs to be justice, and there's a... I completely understand the empathy that you feel when you write about these people, but it's very moving what writers like you do, because it's kind of sacred territory, because you are doing your part to bring them back to life, which means bring them back into the consciousness of people that might make a difference in the case.
Thank you. But, you know, emotionally, it is tough at times. It tends to take a lot out of a person. If you invest that much of yourself into the subject, it's very draining at times, very depleting, very enervating. It really takes a lot out of you.
Well, these are, I mean, next season of this show, I was trying to save some big stories for further seasons of it, but you know, I'm looking at a lot of these names of people like, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Rebecca Schaefer and Dominic Dunn and Dorothy Stratton.
Yes.
And it's just horrifying that all of these beautiful young women were so kind of mistreated in their lives within this Hollywood world. And I guess it's indicative of what happens everywhere. But do you find that, I mean, outside of her murder, did you get the sense that Krista Helm did not suffer fools, like that she was within herself somewhat empowered?
I feel she was empowered, but I also think she was kind of without a rudder once she went to Hollywood. She kind of got in over her head, and I just think it was a different environment for her that maybe she wasn't prepared for. And I just think that she really didn't know how to navigate those waters. I think she may have thought it would have been as easy for her in Hollywood as it had been for her in New York City. But for whatever reason, I don't think that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think she struggled a lot more once she came to Los Angeles. Things didn't fall into place for her like she probably thought they would.
If you had to guess, what element do you think was responsible for her murder?
I think her dalliance with a dangerous crowd out there, the drug dealers, you know, the small-time hoods, mobsters, the dark people, the dark street people. I'm kind of thinking that maybe she devoted a lot of her time and energy into becoming a part of that world for whatever reason. It was seductive to her. It kind of seduced her. She liked living on the edge. But, you know, these were very bad people, you know, and I think she was out of her league with them.
Mm.
Especially with someone like Rudy Mazzella, who was, from what I hear, a total scumbag.
A scary guy, yeah.
Scary guy, yeah. Weird, very strange man.
How many of these people? I mean, and a lot of these people are dead now. Her friend,
yeah.
Her friend Lenny passed on, and you know.
Stephanie says most of those people led such reckless lives. She said, she's almost. Sure that most, she's very certain that most of them are dead. And she said it's just because she turned her life around years ago that she's still alive.
Yeah.
She said because she was on a bad road as well in those years.
Was Krista, I mean, we all are to a certain extent, but do you feel that she was a chameleon of sorts, that she meant that she was different things to different people?
Yes. Absolutely. I've long felt that about her. It's very interesting to me that you bring that up. I think she could adjust her personality to whomever she was with. And
yeah.
that was probably one of her most charming qualities, but it was probably also maddening to people because maybe they never knew who they were getting at any given time.
Mm.
I think she was very adept at doing that. Yeah.
I got two more questions about Krista, and they're pretty pedestrian questions, but that wasn't her birth name. How did she get Krista Helm?
Well, she told one of her friends that an astrologer advised her to change her name from Sandra Lynn Wolfiel, her birth name, to Krista Helm, because that name would bring her great wealth and fame and success. So how true that story is, I don't know, but that's what I was told.
And she had, you say that she had a sister that lived in L.A.
Yeah, Marisa Rahm. Also, she was also known as Marisa Helm. And from what I've been told, she was a go-go dancer or a dancer in nightclubs. And a part-time actress, and kind of a groupie. She had kind of a groupie kind of lifestyle in those years. And I suppose she's still alive. She's still.
Were they close at all?
No, they weren't close. I think there was a lot of jealousy and. There was jealousy there and competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kept them from being, you know, real tight as sisters.
Is there any major part that we're missing of her story? Because you've put in so much work into this. I mean, both writing the article years ago and then going through this 2-week refresher course, and I'm so grateful to you for doing that.
I wanted to make sure that I had something to bring to the table because I know how serious you are about this, and your intentions are totally honorable, and I really applaud you for wanting to do this for her.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. But I don't want to miss anything that you've uncovered that you want to discuss. Is there anything that we're missing?
The only thing I can think of is so many times when working on her article, I wanted to jump into the story and try to save her. And I'm wondering if you understand. I'm wondering if you understand what I mean.
Absolutely, because I'll tell you that was the primary feeling I had when I went on that tour that I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially in hindsight, and you know every detail about the event and what time it happened. In my mind, I was thinking, if only I could go back in time and warn her
yes,
before this happened.
That's right.
You know, as irrational as that sounds.
But no, I totally understand. I wish there was a time capsule that we could take to time travel and just become an advocate for that person and say, look, you know, you don't know what's ahead, but you have to listen to me. And you have to take a different route. You have to get away from this. Yeah, I mean, that's a real strong, strong feeling. I had that a lot.
Yeah. What, do you think that? I mean, that she was talking about. She felt that she was in danger, and she might come home, or she might leave L.A. But do you feel that she had the wherewithal under different circumstances or the talent to actually achieve some level of success in the industry had she lived?
I'm not really sure because the little I've seen of her acting performances, I don't think she was all that talented. I guess she could have gotten better with more training, but I don't think she had... too much raw talent, raw acting talent. So I'm not sure what her future would have been like in that town. That's very intriguing. It's a very intriguing thing to think about.
I think the impression that I get, and in my conversation with Stephen, he kind of reinforced this, is that she wasn't so much concerned with being a serious actress. She just wanted to go straight for the stardom. She wanted to be a star.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know?
I agree. Yep, you're both right. You're both right on that. I totally agree.
So you need to tell me just a little bit, because I mean, I'd be anxious to cover her in the next season. You know, I won't spend a lot of time talking to you about it now. Maybe I'll bring you back on the next season to talk about Barbara Payton. Tell me about the gist of her story and what sucked you into that.
Oh, that would be great, Jamie. Barbara Payton was a young girl from Minnesota. She grew up in a small town, beautiful, blonde, stunning girl. Moved to Hollywood when she was 20. Within a year of her being in town, she got the lead role in a James Cagney film called Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. She was signed to Warner Brothers Studios, but she was extremely wild and reckless. This is the 1950s. And very promiscuous. Hope wound up blackmailing him, trying to extort money from all these different men. And there was a huge scandal in 1951 in which she was the center of. Two actors by the name of Franco Tone and Tom Neal engaged in a brutal fist fight over her affections. And Tone was sent to the hospital in a coma, and he almost died. And it killed her career overnight. She was earning $10,000 a week at Warner Brothers. And within a couple of years, she made her last film. And after that, she was arrested numerous times, beaten up. She wound up living on Skid Row in Hollywood. She became a prostitute. And she wound up dying of heart and liver failure at 39 years old. And they said at the time of her death, she looked like she was in her 60s. And I've written a book about her life called Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. I researched and wrote the book. It took me 10 years to research and to write it. And it's gotten some good reviews on Amazon if you ever have a chance to check them out.
I'll buy the book. The book itself is on.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I'll buy the book, yes.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. If I had a spare book, I would send it to you, but all my comps are long gone.
No. But, I'll be happy to buy it.
Oh, I appreciate it. I really do. It's a very haunting story. Extremely sad. It's probably the saddest story other than Sharon. I think Sharon Tate's is the saddest Hollywood story.
Oh, yeah.
But Barbara's, and of course, Krista's is very sad. Elizabeth Short, you know, because of the way they died. But Barbara's decline was so protracted. It went on and on and on for years, and her life just kept getting worse and worse with no let up. And she was at the end of her life. She was obese and toothless. She had sores all over her face. And
at 39.
At 39.
Wow.
Yes. And it was just a tragedy because she really had potential. She was a good actress, and she could have been a big star. So, that's my baby. That was something I worked on for a long, long time.
It sounds like personality-wise that she was quite the unique woman for her time, though.
Exactly. And a lot like Krista. You know, there were elements of Krista's personality that absolutely reminded me of Barbara.
Mm.
And though that living on the edge type person, I find that fascinating, especially when they don't seem to be of the times in which they live. That's mm-hmm. really what nails it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of people who don't live like the mass majority live, you know,
right.
in that same time period.
And what role does that play in their demise? The fact that
exactly.
they weren't the norm. Yeah.
I think it plays a huge role, actually. A huge role. But my story has been optioned. My Barbara Payton story has been optioned by two film producers in Los Angeles, and they're trying to develop it for a film project.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm really keeping my fingers crossed about that. But, you know, I know that could probably take several years. That's what people tell me.
That's a long process. But you know, you think about these stories I mean, I was talking about the Black Dahlia the other day with someone a homicide investigator that actually thinks his father killed the Black Dahlia. And I was listening to his story. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. But I was listening to him and I was saying, why isn't this a movie? Because they haven't made a good Black Dahlia movie yet. And a role like Barbara Payton, any actress alive would be salivating for a role like that.
Well, because it would run the emotional gamut, you know,
yeah.
and the physical changes that the actress would have to display. You know, it's sort of like, who was it, Robert De Niro, when he was in Raging Bull, didn't he have to gain, I don't know, 80 pounds or something? It would be the same for whatever actress was chosen to play Barbara. She would just have to go through a complete metamorphosis.
And,
wow. I'm hoping it'll happen because I really think it could be an Oscar Oscar-winning role for the right actress if the script is good, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the first thing that came to mind for me. And there are so many, the biopic genre is littered with so many bland titles. I mean, the approach is usually very bland and stale. But a subject like Barbara Payton or The Black Dahlia, if it's done right, I mean, those are just that content is so compelling.
Now, what happened with the Black Dahlia film? I know it was a bomb, wasn't it? Wasn't there a Black Dahlia film several years ago,
yes.
5 or 6 years ago?
I'll tell you,
it
was so disheartening to me because it was directed by Brian De Palma, and I am an unabashed Brian De Palma geek. So we did a tribute show to him years ago, and he heard it, and he was complimenting us on it. And I said, "Would you come on our show so we can interview you because you're one of our heroes?" And he said, "Sure."
Yeah.
So I have a real soft spot for him, but and he was perfect for a Black Dahlia movie. The problem is, this wasn't a Black Dahlia movie. It was about the love lives of the cops investigating the Black Dahlia. It was complete misjudgment.
Why did they do that? That's such a waste of potent subject matter.
It was based on the James Ellroy book, and James Ellroy's book was very fictionalized. It just used the Dahlia as like a setup to explore that world in Hollywood at that time. You're right. Just a complete wasted opportunity. So there's yet to be a great movie on that.
Wasn't it filmed in Europe, too?
It was, but I'll tell you, that's the one great thing about the movie is it looks beautiful.
Okay.
It's beautifully shot. Yeah.
It was supposedly filmed on a huge soundstage somewhere in Belgium or I don't know where.
In Berlin, because they got good costs there.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. It's beautiful to look at. It really is.
I really believe that if Barbara's story is filmed properly, it could be another L.A. Confidential. I swear. I hope that doesn't sound like a delusion of grandeur. But I think if it's done properly, it could be just as strong and powerful as L.A. Confidential. Because, oh, my God, wait till you read what her life was about. She was absolutely over the top. A total exhibitionist, totally off the wall. One scandal after another, and gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous, and talented. She really had acting ability, and yet she's forgotten. I mean, you've never heard of her.
No.
She's all but forgotten nowadays.
Well, as soon as I'm telling you, as soon as I'll buy the book tonight, and as soon as I can get my head above water and I finish the series this month because I'm having to read so many books to research the series. I'm gonna tear into your book because I'm fascinated by her story and what you told me about.
That's very kind of you. I appreciate that. That's very kind. Thank you.
No problem at all. And if you, I'll make sure that you get a link to the show. And if I have any questions, I'll email you some questions if they pop up.
Don't hesitate. Now, when will you be speaking with Darlene? Do you think that'll be coming up soon?
Darlene says that I'm going to give her some options. She wrote me back and she said, I'd absolutely love to do it. How can I get in touch with you? And so I'm going to give her some options for times that we can speak. And I'm sure it'll be in the next week. And then Nicole, I talked to her Monday night. She wants to talk.
Oh, great. Great.
I do have a question about contacts. And I ran into this with the Dahlia too, because these cold cases in LA, I have no idea how to get in touch with the LAPD cold cases.
I think Steve Thompson's wife would know how to do that, because if I'm not mistaken, she's the one who reached out to them when we were working on our article.
She evidently
has some knowledge on how to do that. Yeah, I was never in touch with Brandon Berger Harris. I was never in touch with either of them. Or Nicole may know. I'm sure Nicole knows.
Okay. I'll ask of her next week. I'm sure you did. Did Barbara Payton have a lot of living relatives that you were able to speak to?
Oh yeah, in fact, her son actually worked with me on the book. At first, he didn't want any part of it because his mother. She's been so maligned over the years, you know, just so maligned and degraded in print. But once he saw what my intent was, that I wanted to bring out her humanity and her many good qualities, that won him over. And we wound up becoming wonderful friends, and we've stayed friends to this day.
And
in fact,
wonderful.
He wrote the foreword to the book. So he's totally behind it. He supported it. He's happy with it. He said a lot of it brought him a lot of pain, reliving those times with her. But he's glad that I did it, because I set the record straight, and he felt it needed to be set straight.
Oh, it had to be cathartic for him. How old was he when she passed?
Well, actually, he was 20 when she passed, but she lost custody of him when he was 10 years old, and not only did she lose custody of him, she never saw him again. They kept him away. The family kept him away from his mother. Even though she wanted to see him, they wouldn't allow it. So she never saw him again. And that's when her downfall, her decline, really accelerated.
Yeah, I would bet.
To me, that's the cruelest punishment to do to a mother.
Yeah.
You know, to keep her from knowing her son. It's heartbreaking.
Mm.
But her lifestyle was so bad by then. She couldn't help herself. She really couldn't.
Yeah.
And I mean, the people she slept with is like a who's who of Hollywood. She's very promiscuous. Very.
But you know, you hear about, I guess it's the nature of the creative community. There are a lot of outside-of-the-box personalities, a lot of very eccentric personalities, and they all gather in this one community called Hollywood. So whenever we hear like these really horrible stories of murder or scandal or any of that, it seems to just all be a part of those people that don't fit in anywhere else. They converge in this one area.
They're fringe characters.
Yes.
You know, to us, I mean, with our bourgeois sensibilities, we're shocked, but it's normal for them. That's the way life is. And they're on a totally different sphere, you know. I think it's cool, actually, and I kind of understand the way they operate.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by it. I really am.
I am too. But I mean that whole culture and how the Manson family story fits right into that, the outsiders that didn't fit in anywhere else, and I mean that's a cautionary tale. If you're of that ilk that don't feel like you fit in anywhere else, I mean there's always false prophets out there that are trying to manipulate you. But then they
latched on to Dennis Wilson, who was a success, and you know it was two different worlds converging. You know, it's fascinating as hell.
Yeah.
So totally fascinating. I mean, I'm like you. I could eat up those stories, and I do eat them up. I mean, honestly eat up those stories.
I mean, I have 50 hours of Dateline mystery shows on my TiVo. I'm obsessed with those mystery, you know, so I wanted to. But at the same time, I wanted to kind of try my best to humanize each person that we're discussing on this series, too. I mean, that was my main objective.
But I have to be honest with you, modern Hollywood leaves me cold.
Sure.
You know, a lot of modern Hollywood leaves me cold because they're not living on the edge. How can they be living on the edge when everyone and their brother is behaving the same way? You know, it's not cutting edge behavior. It doesn't take guts to be outrageous nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot. I think first of all, it's the nature of that we know everything about everyone now, and the whole nature of celebrity has changed. It used to be that you actually had to accomplish something to be a celebrity,
right? And then
there are no Robert Mitchums anymore. Like, where's our Robert Mitchum? Genuine people, you know?
Yeah. They were trying to say Colin Farrell was the new Robert Mitchum. I'm like, no.
I like him fine, but Robert Mitchum does not exist. He's nowhere to be found.
That's true. Yeah.
But you know what? You know what I think it is, too? I think it's a change in the culture. I think you look around, and men have become more, and I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing, but they've become more feminized in a way. So I think it's
Lauren,
a cultural thing.
I think Lauren Bacall even said something along those lines. She made a quote about that. Especially today's leading men in Hollywood were more feminized, or more feminized, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you can't imagine Robert Mitchum ever talking about his feelings.
Yeah, you're right. Although they say he was a very nice man, you know. And I've actually seen him speak very lovingly about Marilyn Monroe. I don't know if you've seen an interview clip on YouTube. He speaks very lovingly about her. So he had a tender side, you know, but he just didn't show it to everyone.